Charlie Pelham, an 86-year-old who is in wheelchair after four spells in hospital this year, and Eric Griffiths, a 57-year-old who is registered deaf and blind, said they both need home care packages, but that these have either been unavailable or unsuitable, leaving them to fend for themselves. Eric Griffiths said, "Imagine me being blind, pushing a wheelchair. I was crashing into bus stops and tipping him out into the road because I couldn't see what I was doing. I get Charlie ready and I'm doing all the shopping by myself, doing all the cooking and the cleaning. It's really hard, but what can you do? It's got to be done." John Merry of Salford City Council said, "There are challenges with the number of care workers. This is a national issue not unique to Salford, and we're working hard to bring in more service providers so there is enough resilience and capacity in care supply." In Leicestershire, Deirdre Thomas, a 68-year-old, helps look after her mother, Jean, but has been looking for evening care for 6 months. She said, "My mother, Jean, is 99 years old and pretty wobbly. My heart is in my mouth. I'm so terrified she will fall over. An ambulance won't come and I will never see her again." Caroline Abrams, the charity director of Age UK, said urgent action is required to even keep the system viable, adding, "For older and disabled people, the consequences of this crisis in care can be very severe." The Department of Health and Social Care said, "Care homes and home care providers are benefiting from hundreds of millions of pounds of investment in the social care workforce, including through a dedicated recruitment and retention fund. COVID-19 pressures are continuously kept under review, and the need for further support will be assessed as we go through the winter period."
When it comes to the Israeli occupation of Palestine, people usually talk about the crimes the regime has committed in this land. But Israel couldn't destroy the Palestinian people's homeland if it didn't have the support of Britain. The sad story of the occupation and its concomitant sufferings dates back to over 100 years ago. In 1916, once Britain's Prime Minister, then the Foreign Secretary, Arthur Balfour, promised Palestine to the Jewish community in Britain. Then, on November 2, 1917, he made it official in the form of a letter addressed to the leader of the Jewish community and a member of the Zionist movement in Britain, Walter Rothschild. At the time, Britain was not even in control of Palestine, as it was still part of the Ottoman Empire. Either way, Palestine was never Balfour's to transfer so casually to anyone else. The letter, known as the Balfour Declaration, marked the beginning of the occupation of Palestine.
A group of Zionists met in London in 1917 on July the 17th to draft the formula for a declaration to be made by the British government that would in fact provide the underpinnings and the justification for Jewish immigration to Palestine and the creation of a national homeland. And so on July 17th, the Zionist organization completed work that it had been working on for a long time and drafted a declaration which was to be forwarded on to the British government. The British government then spent 4 or 5 months debating the formula for the declaration, slightly adjusted it, and issued it at the beginning of November in 1917.
When the intentions of the British and their rapport with the Zionists became too apparent, Palestinians started to protest, a kind that has never ceased, over a century later. The reason is, of course, too apparent, since the horrific consequences of British colonialism and the eventual complete Zionist takeover of Palestine are still felt after all these years. Paltry attempts to pacify Palestinian anger were to no avail, especially after the League of Nations Council in July 1922 approved the terms of the British Mandate for Palestine. It came without consulting the Palestinians, who would disappear from the British and international radar only to reappear as negligible rioters, troublemakers, and obstacles to the joint British-Zionist colonial concoctions. Despite occasional assurances, the British intention of ensuring the establishment of an exclusively Jewish state in Palestine was becoming clearer with time. The Balfour Declaration was hardly an aberration, but had indeed set the stage for the full-scale ethnic cleansing that followed decades later.
We are here in the neighborhood, the Palestinian neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah in occupied East Jerusalem. We come here every week and to say no to the occupation, no to apartheid, no to ethnic cleansing. The Israeli government is planning to deport the indigenous people, Palestinian people, from their home in order to evacuate it for settlers, for Jewish settlers, for colonialists.
After World War II, the UK appeared as less influential in the international arena compared to what it used to be. However, it continued to support Israel in every possible way. In November 1967, after the Six-Day War, Britain co-authored the UN Resolution 242, which could have led to a full Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. However, it did very little to insist on its implementation as a permanent member of the UN Security Council. While many might argue that Britain has been more vocal towards Israeli crimes against Palestinians, London has taken no real action to condemn Israel for the crimes it commits in the occupied territories. For example, Britain could have issued a symbolic apology in 2017 on the centenary of the Balfour Declaration. It could have been a moment of reckoning for Britain, but it was not. Instead, the government of then Prime Minister Theresa May celebrated the occasion with Israeli authorities. In the meantime, the British government continues to advocate for the so-called two-state solution, a Palestinian state side by side with Israel. But in reality, it's only protecting the interests of the Israelis.
Mr. Deputy Speaker, 3 years ago, on the 9th of November 2011, the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Member for Richmondshire, then Foreign Secretary, told this House, and I quote, "The United Kingdom judges that the Palestinian Authority largely fulfills criteria for United Nations membership, including statehood." And he added, and again I quote, "We reserve the right, we the United Kingdom, reserve the right to recognise a Palestinian state bilaterally at a moment of our choosing and when it can best help bring about peace." Mr. Deputy Speaker, that moment is now. I urge honourable members on all sides to support this amendment.
What we want is to see an Israel that is at peace with its neighbours, and I should remind you that the policy of our government is for a two-state solution, which is what we want to achieve and hope to help to bring about in a modest and humble way.
In fact, every time Palestine was getting close to claiming its rights, the UK came forward and stalled the process. When asked for clarification on the question of Palestinian statehood, then UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab sent a letter to the Balfour Project reiterating an old position. The British government will recognize a Palestinian state at a time when it best serves the objective of peace.
Well, I'm looking forward to meeting leaders on all sides in Israel, in the Palestinian territories, President Abbas, obviously Prime Minister Netanyahu, Foreign Minister Ashkenazi. And look, I'm here because we are a strong friend of Israel, but we also feel very strongly that we want to see a peaceful two-state solution. We've got the ceasefire. The question is now how we can build on that, bed that in, avoid any further escalations, and try and find a track towards a two-state solution.
In just another example, back in April 2021, UK opposed the ICC investigation, saying it does not accept that the ICC has jurisdiction in this instance, partly since Palestine is not a sovereign state. Needless to say, the two-state idea is completely rejected by Palestinians, since they know all too well that none of the Western countries that talk about such a solution are on their side. That said, the resistance movement insists, as the only viable solution, on a public referendum participated in only by those who have roots in the land. Britain still talks about the so-called solution, but in reality, Israel has already killed the idea, trying to become a full-blown apartheid regime with international blessing. The support that Israel gets from Britain is not limited to these policies. In December 2020, Britain and Israel signed a military cooperation agreement.
Battle-tested on civilian populations around the world. Today, specifically, a Stop Arming Israel Day, because our government licenses weapons to a regime which is occupying a people and is using those weapons against the people, as we've seen over the last year, against ordinary people marching for freedom in Gaza.
There are also huge arms deals between the two as well. The UK has bought £46 million worth of military equipment from Israeli arms firm Elbit in the past 4 years. British soldiers have also been stationed in Israel since day one of the occupation. They give the Israelis military advice and training. The ties between Britain and Israel are so tight that the UK can never have an impartial stance when it comes to the Palestine issue, no matter who occupies the number 10 in Downing Street. Yet this unholy alliance has been at the expense of the Palestinian people, who have been geographically fragmented between refugee camps, in the diaspora, militarily occupied, and treated as second-class citizens in a land their ancestors dwelt since time immemorial.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Resolution 194 enshrines the right of return of Palestinians displaced from their homeland, but the Zionist regime has ignored it. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Qada Karmi, former research fellow at the Institute of Arab and Islamic Studies, University of Exeter. This article is published under the heading, "The Denial of the Palestinian Right of Return is a Crime as Great as the Nakba." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. It is that time of year when yet another anniversary of disappointed hopes looms over Palestinians. 73 years ago, on December 11, 1948, Resolution 194 was passed by the United Nations General Assembly. It was of enormous legal and moral significance, enshrining the right of return of Palestinians displaced from their homeland by the Zionist regime's creation, to return home or to be compensated for the loss of their property. Coming so soon after the mass expulsion of Palestine's population during the Nakba in May 1948, it seemed a perfect antidote to that disaster, offering a lifeline to devastated Palestinians. Resolution 194 has been reaffirmed by the UN every year since 1949, attesting to its continuing relevance, but it has never been implemented, thanks to the Zionist regime's ferocious opposition and Western inaction. From the outset, the UN, aware of the Zionist regime's anxieties about a refugee return, took pains to use careful language in its wording of the resolution. Its request for the Zionist regime to repatriate refugees wishing to return to their homes and live at peace with their neighbors should be permitted to do so at the earliest practicable date can only be seen in that light, against the background of a clear international consensus on the absolute legal and humanitarian right of individual return, without condition or caveat. This was an extraordinary concession to the Israeli regime concerns. It set the stage for the subsequent tolerance of the Zionist regime's continued intransigence over the right of Palestinian return. The consequences have been hugely damaging to Palestinians. All the ills that have beset them since 1948 can be linked back to that denial of their right of return. Had it been allowed, there would be no Palestinian refugees. More than 5 million are registered with the UN today, or refugee camps, of which there are around 5,000. The UN Relief and Works Agency, set up specifically to care for Palestinian refugees in 1949, would never have existed. No Palestinian would have to endure the limbo of statelessness or be labeled terrorists for exercising their legitimate right to resist the Zionist regime's oppressive rule. Gaza would not be under an inhumane 14-year siege with no end in sight. Palestinians who sought refuge in their countries of exile would no longer have to be treated as burdens or second-class citizens. They would have retained their dignity and self-respect, save in the knowledge that they had a homeland of their own. Nor would Palestinians have suffered the psychological and social effects of exile, even harder to reverse than physical exclusion. What before 1948 had been a cohesive society with its own customs and norms was comprehensively smashed by the Zionist regime's establishment. Worse still, the Zionist regime then set about trying to erase all traces of the Palestinian presence in the land it had taken over. Hundreds of villages were demolished. Arabic place names were replaced by Hebrew, and a new Israeli narrative wrote Palestinians out of the country's history. The aspects of Palestinian culture not destroyed in this endeavor were appropriated as Israeli cuisine, embroidery, even the Dabka dance. How can a people dispersed and fragmented around the world for decades return to this altered Palestine? In each place of exile, there have been changes in culture, customs, and lifestyle. Younger generations may identify more with their current surroundings than with Palestine. How will such desperate communities learn to live together again? Return has long been a common theme that united a dispersed people. But if they did return, what unifying idea would take its place? What sort of Palestine, with what type of governance and social norms, do returnees want to live in? Had Palestinians remained in their native land, they would never have faced these hard questions. Their society would have evolved naturally. Rebuilding a Palestinian society today, on the other hand, entails a huge task. Reversing the effects of an exile that need never have happened. The denial of the Palestinian right of return was a crime as great as the Nakba. It started with deliberate negligence with regards to the Zionist regime's admission to the UN in 1949.
Plants grow and give fruits and flowers when they are in the most ideal circumstances. Proper amount of sun, water, soil conditions, and the right temperature are all the ingredients for a happy plant to grow and do what it does best. These days, being a successful farmer is a much more complicated and demanding profession than in the past. Farmers today not only need to have great agricultural skills, but they also must have exceptional technological and marketing expertise. And the most recent trend in farming are greenhouses.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. In this program, we will explore new developments in Iran's vast agriculture industry while shining the spotlight on greenhouses. We wanted to see what all the fanfare is about with this type of farming. Plus, we will also check out how it's making profits in the agriculture sector. So plant yourself in a comfortable seat and let's start the show.
Our journey began at Farakish de Parsia. This company has been around for decades and has a rich history of activity in livestock rearing and farming. Some years ago, it launched a new business specializing in high-tech hydroponic greenhouses. It's an indoor farm with greenhouses built on many hectares of land. Mainly, it grows three types of produce and a variety of tomatoes, peppers, and lettuce. Each year, it may focus on growing a single type of crop, such as peppers. They have perfected Mother Nature indoors through a combination of science and technology married with farming. The goal is to provide sustainable indoor farming solutions that optimize the use of natural resources. Hydroponic greenhouses grow crops in nutrient-rich water, so water management is at the heart of this company. The structures are created with state-of-the-art irrigation systems. Also, rainwater is collected and distributed to plants. Drainage from the plants is gathered in pools where it undergoes a purification process to remove contaminants, then recycled back into the system. But that's not all. Special ventilation systems control temperature and air circulation. The greenhouses are equipped with shades to control natural light, plus they are fitted with heating and cooling systems. This type of farming comes at a time when the country is witnessing unprecedented heat and water shortages, partially because of outdated agricultural practices.
This type of farming is growing in popularity. The technical term for hydroponic farming is controlled environmental agriculture, or simply indoor farming. These greenhouses create precise growing conditions using technological advances like digital monitoring that draw out the best flavors and textures in produce. And they can be built almost anywhere.
Aside from being a major producer itself, this company offers its hydroponic technology to farmers and growers. Plus, it helps them plant their own greenhouses. It gets its seedlings from its own massive nursery. The seeds are hybrids that are imported. Using hybrid seeds helps grow crops that match international quality, which is beneficial when exporting their produce. This company collaborates with research and academic institutions for agricultural research of cash crops, such as saffron and blueberries. The company stands on the threshold of exporting its produce and welcomes foreign investments to expand its activities. As part of their future vision, they are creating a program for on-site training, which helps users of hydroponic technology in glass greenhouses. Additionally, it is developing lodging and accommodation for national and international agritourists. The most recent addition to their line of work is a packing facility which packages produce and readies them for market distribution. While the U.S. sanctions do not directly cover the agriculture sector, they have indirectly impacted businesses in this industry. Much of the technology used in this company is imported or has spare parts that need to be imported. The sanctions have hindered international money transfers, making imports and even exports of produce for this company difficult.
As you might know, open land farming is vulnerable to environmental changes. Droughts, cold spells, heat waves, and soil erosion all impact harvests. The agriculture sector not only plays a big role in managing food security, but also is a big contributor to the Iranian economy. In recent years, water shortages have slowed development in this sector, which has gained the attention of government officials.
The Ministry of Agriculture defines several programs to develop greenhouses to tackle drought conditions. Right now, the total greenhouse area in the country stands at around 21,000 hectares. Government officials want to increase this amount to 25,000 by the end of the year. This will help support plans of the Ministry of Agriculture to transfer vegetable farms to greenhouses. The main objective is to save 10 billion cubic meters of water annually. Many of these greenhouses are set up in agriculture parks inside free trade zones. In fact, in the Northwest, Aras Free Trade Zone opened one of the biggest hydroponic greenhouse complexes in West Asia. The goal is to increase productions for exports. For this reason, agri-parks have a major role in developing technology to support efficient indoor farming. The government provided nearly $200 million worth of funds for creating agricultural parks and greenhouses last year. And this supportive measure has paid off, as over 4 million tons of fruits and vegetables were produced this year from greenhouses. Tehran province is one of the country's biggest producers of greenhouse products. Yazd, West Azerbaijan, Bushehr, and Khorasan provinces also have numerous greenhouses, just to name a few.
Iranian agriculture has grown by leaps and bounds in recent years. It was one of the only sectors that was barely impacted by the global coronavirus outbreak. Agriculture is not limited to cultivation and farming alone. It also includes dairy, poultry, beekeeping, aquaculture, and so much more. It is considered a strategic sector where goods are enhanced with added value through processing, promotion, and distribution.
Agriculture makes up 8% of Iran's GDP and employs one-fifth of the country's entire workforce. Iran's agro-food products also accounted for around 20% of the country's non-oil exports last year. That's according to the Ministry of Agriculture. Figures from the ministry show Iran has over 18 million hectares of arable land. And last year, nearly 130 million tons of agro-products were produced in farmlands. Iran's agro-industry is worth billions. Data from Iran's Customs Administration show the value of the country's agricultural exports rose by around 3% this year. Its figures also reveal Iran exported some 5 million tons of agricultural products worth nearly $3 billion this year. Around half of the revenue generated from exports belonged to 10 major agricultural products. Championing the top of the export list was pistachio, selling off roughly $540 million worth of nuts. This was followed by watermelon and tomatoes in terms of export value. Horticulture products also generated $1 billion in exports. When one hears the name of the textile industry, the first thing that comes to mind is the multi-billion dollar fashion industry. That's partially true, but it turns out that textiles have many uses outside of the fashion world. They are an important part of the medical field, toy manufacturing, weaponry, agriculture, and other unexpected fields. The Industrial Revolution indeed expanded this industry over the years. All textiles are made of fibers, and innovation, speed, and flexibility have built the spinning sector as we know it.
We will explore the vast textile industry with a particular look at synthetic fibers. We wanted to see where this industry gets its raw material by looking at the contributions of petrochemical sector. We will uncover how synthetic fibers are made and why they are such an integral part of other upstream industries.
This week, our journey took us to an industrial complex in the town of Karchak near the capital Tehran. We wanted to see who helps tie the textile industry together, so we visited a manufacturer that specializes in producing synthetic threads. Nasojan Parse Mehris was first established in 2016, and its main product is polyester thread. Its massive production hall has the capacity to produce tons of this item each day. Its products are sold to numerous textile companies across the nation. Mainly, its customers are manufacturers of fabrics for curtains, upholstery, and the garment industry, to name a few. Production all starts with polyester granules, which are made by the petrochemical industry. Partially oriented yarn is made from this material. Dozens of people are employed at the production lines to work in shifts around the clock. Production never really stops at this facility. Partially oriented yarn is a term used to describe a polyester thread that is not completely stretched. This creates a less uniform appearance and is used to make texture in fabrics. This company makes different types of threads which are used for different purposes in down-the-line industries.
Well, there are two main steps to making polyester thread. In the first step, chips are fed to a machine called the vacuum dryer. After roughly 12 hours, the moisture is reduced and then the material is fed through a hopper to an extruder where it is heated and melted. After other steps, it is fed to a machine for pulling. Each step requires accuracy and precision to make high-quality threads.
The beating heart of this company is the quality control unit. Here, threads are tested for their strength and uniformity based on specifications of its productions. The results are then grouped into three categories based on their quality. The highest grades are then packaged and released into the market. Because of Iran's strategic geographical location, this company easily exports its products to Turkey and competes with other big exporters, such as China and India. This manufacturer's main claim to fame is the high quality of its thread. With such large productions, this company is eyeing the expansion of its production facilities. It has already implemented a second phase of production expansion, and the feasibility study for the third phase is in the works. These developments offer numerous investment opportunities as well. Most of the raw material needed to make polyester threads are domestically produced, with the exception of the spin finishes. The majority of finishes need to be imported. These oils are used because of their properties for increasing thread performance and processability of polyester yarns. These features add value to threads, which makes spin finishes a vital ingredient in the production mix. However, the U.S. imposed sanctions have made importing this item difficult over the years.
Polyester has gained a significant role in the textile industry. Some 50 years ago, cotton was the most important fiber in this industry. But over the years, this changed. Population growth meant prioritizing food crops, which decreased the area for cotton cultivation. So demand for polyester fibers grew such that it is now called the king of fibers in the textile industry.
At present, the most important raw material in the textile industry is polyester. It dominates 60% of material used in the textile production cycle. This is followed by cotton and then a small amount of other natural fibers, such as wool and silk. Other synthetic fibers, such as acrylic, nylon, and polypropylene, are also used in this industry, among others. The main raw material used to make polyester threads are granules, which are produced in large amounts in the petrochemical industry. Domestic polyester granule production is dominated by a handful of companies with a combined annual production of over 420,000 tons. That's according to the Ministry of Industries, Mining and Trade. This amount is largely set for the making of polyester threads and is said to be enough for domestic needs. The petrochemical industry also produces other granules, which are used across almost all industrial sectors. Last year, Iran's total thread production stood at around 48,000 tons. 25% of the raw material used in this production was from cotton. That's based on figures from the National Textile Association. The country makes a lot of cotton, but it is still not nearly enough to meet demands. The domestic demand is roughly around 120,000 tons of cotton annually. This is why local productions last year stood at around 60,000 tons.
Polyester is derived from polymers made by the petrochemical industry. It's not surprising that Iran's polymer industry is exponentially expanding given its large oil reserves. Various manufacturing sectors, such as the textile industry, plastics, and even automobile industry, are heavily dependent on petrochemical products. So how are productions in this sector doing?
Currently, over 6 million tons of polymer products are domestically produced each year. That's based on statistics from the National Plastics and Polymer Industrial Association. Of this amount, some 3 million tons of raw material are exported with a value of $3 billion. The other half of total productions is domestically used to make added value products. These items include polyester string, fabrics, tires, dishes, and containers, and a whole lot more. In total, the association puts the combined exports of petrochemical and polymer products at around $12 billion. Iran's Oil, Gas, and Petrochemical Products Exporters Union predicts an increase in added value of petrochemical products. The union estimates products made from petchems will reach a value of $18 billion in exports by the end of this year. The government has implemented policies and initiatives to increase added value through industries that use these raw materials. All in all, there are numerous opportunities in this sector and the ever-growing textile industry. It is an industry that has built a bridge between past and present with an eye on the future.
All right, everyone, it is time for me to step aside for several minutes as my good friend and colleague is about to take you on another educational adventure. Enjoy.
We live in a world where our lives are becoming increasingly intertwined with the zeros and ones. We transfer money, we call our friends, and we do our shopping using these two magic numbers that form the foundation of the virtual yet real world that's called IT. Today, I'll walk you around this Iranian company that has a lot to say when it comes to the IT sector.
Here, only the impossible is impossible. This is the motto which Ida Bonyan Moptakere Pars has set his targets on. the Iranian brand develops a range of IT and ICT products, from apps and websites to educational content. The idea of launching such a business was developed more than a decade and a half ago in the mind of its CEO when he was just a high school student.
E-commerce is one of the amazing outcomes of the digital space. The emergence of online shopping has provided an instant link between customers and sellers, where customers can easily window shop and get their hands on their desired items in a tap of a finger.
Minikala is the name of a newbie online shopping app that's developed by the thriving brand. In less than 2 years, the number of Minikala users is rapidly approaching 500K. Ide Bunyane Mubtekere Pars is an umbrella company that has under its belt a range of startups producing apps with different purposes, from money management apps to shopping and medical applications. This is what makes this firm stand out from the ever-growing number of rivals in Iran.
Despite its adverse effect on the global economy, when it comes to digital marketing, the coronavirus pandemic was a blessing, making the online space the safest possible channel for people to get their hands on different products. And this company says it fares even better during the pandemic.
Many companies went bankrupt, almost bankrupt, during the coronavirus pandemic. But when it comes to the online shopping and the digital marketing, it was a blessing in disguise.
With a dedicated team bringing together more than 150 highly driven programmers, Mubtekere says it tries to expand the scope of its activity based on the needs of the day. Otherwise, it would stay behind in the fast-paced market.
The IT sector is an ever-growing industry, and it requires businesses to catch up with the latest trends in the industry.
Many thanks for that awesome report. All right then, we're almost out of time for this show, but before we go, let's check out some trends and developments in the country's agriculture sector. One of the biggest concerns for most farmers is how to best control pests. Now, an Iranian developer has used nanotechnology to formulate a pesticide.
This nanopesticide, which is biodegradable and biocompatible, kills pests without causing environmental contamination. The developer says this product can be used on pistachio, citrus trees, cotton, sugar beets, and other plants as well. Many synthesized pesticides used around the world in agriculture can throw the natural ecosystem off balance. They not only kill off the pests, but also valuable insects and organisms that help combat pests. Nanopesticides are being hailed as an emerging technology that will minimize the harmful effects of pesticides on people and the environment.
As you might already know, the right amount of water is critical in getting high crop yields. One of the ways that the government manages water resources in agriculture is by implementing modern irrigation systems.
In Ardabil province, nearly 5,000 hectares of farmland was fitted with updated irrigation systems. Provincial officials are planning to increase this amount to 15,000 hectares by the end of this year. Upgrading farmland irrigation methods is part of a program outlined by the Ministry of Agriculture. Feasibility studies for this project show it will increase irrigation efficiency by 44%, and production capacity is expected to rise by 30% with optimized irrigation. The program director says 150,000 hectares of land now have modern irrigation across Iran.
The agriculture industry is massive, and the scope of it doesn't really sink in until there is an opportunity to visit an agriculture trade show such as the one that was kicked off in the capital city of Tehran.
Some 150 companies participated in this exhibition. Businesses showcased their latest achievements in the field of irrigation, animal feed, greenhouses, and agricultural mechanization. This is the sixth year the exhibition is being held at the International Fairgrounds. It is a platform where industry participants can connect with researchers and technology developers. The event covers several thematic sections, such as horticulture, aquaculture, and processing and packing, among others.
And that wraps up our show for today. Don't forget to leave your feedback. Also, you can share your thoughts and comments with us through our email. Until next time.
is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Limelight.
President Biden is navigating a politically fraught path on climate change after last weekend's deadly tornadoes, stopping short on Monday, 13th of December, of directly blaming global warming for the disaster, but emphasizing the storm's extreme nature and ordering officials to get more definitive answers. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Washington Post journalists Sean Sullivan, Annie Linsky, and Scott Clement. The piece is titled, Biden Walks a Careful Line on Climate After Tornadoes. Stay with us for more. President Biden is navigating a politically fraught path on climate change after last weekend's deadly tornadoes, stopping short on Monday, 13th of December, of directly blaming global warming for the disaster, but emphasizing the storm's extreme nature and ordering officials to get more definitive answers. President Biden, facing an unusual series of violent weather events during his first year in office, has been forced to change the way presidents have long dealt with natural disasters. A task that once involved calling local leaders, offering aid, and consoling victims. All things that Joe Biden has done has expanded to far more politically sensitive terrain. Scientists are drawing clearer lines between global warming and destructive weather, often prompting Biden to warn of the urgent need to address rising temperatures. And some climate activists say the tornadoes underline the urgency of swift action. But Republicans are eager to pounce on any exaggeration of climate change's impact, putting pressure on Biden not to get ahead of what is verifiable. "We have to be very careful. We can't say with absolute certainty that it was because of climate change," Joe Biden said on Monday, 13th of December, after officials briefed him on the tornadoes. But he added, "What is certain, it is one of the worst tornado disasters we've had in the country. And the second thing that's certain is that it is unusual. It is unusual how it happened, how many places it touched down, and the length of the path. So that's all I'm prepared to talk about right now." President Biden on Wednesday, 15th of December, plans to visit Kentucky, where tornadoes killed at least 74 people. At least 14 more were killed in other states. Kentucky leans heavily conservative and is the home of Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, a vocal critic of Joe Biden's climate agenda. Senator Mitch McConnell did not mention climate change in a floor speech on Monday on the tornadoes. President Biden said he has ordered the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, and other departments to delve more deeply into whether climate change is responsible for the tornadoes or contributed to their ferocity. Although the precise connection between climate change and tornadoes is not certain, experts have said that higher temperatures could intensify these violent storms. The recovery efforts come at a moment when climate change is at the center of Joe Biden's domestic agenda. He's trying to push a bill across the finish line on Capitol Hill that, among other things, would make historic investments in fighting climate change. His administration is also promoting a new infrastructure law that makes large investments in a vast network of electric vehicle charging stations. Meanwhile, Vice President Kamala Harris traveled to Maryland on Monday to focus attention on the administration's push to electrify the country's transportation system. "There can be no doubt the future of transportation in our nation and around the world is electric," Kamala Harris said. Without directly referring to the tornadoes over the weekend, Harris noted that a reason for the administration's urgency on climate is the extreme weather that is increasingly gripping the country, from wildfires to tornadoes to floods. "Across our nation, rising sea levels are flooding streets," Harris said. "Wildfires are burning out of control." Scientists and environmentalists describe climate change as an existential threat that could cause untold harm to humans and other species if far-reaching changes are not made fast. And Biden has made tackling this problem a centerpiece of its domestic and foreign policy blueprints. But Republicans are quick to criticize Biden's climate agenda as an overreaction to an exaggerated problem that will cost jobs and raise prices. Robert Stavins, director of Harvard University's Environmental Economics Program, said relying too heavily on extreme weather to make the case for climate mitigation can backfire, because opponents can point to stretches of fair or frigid weather to argue that action isn't needed. He recalled a Republican senator organizing activists to stand outside in Washington during a snowstorm with signs that read, "Honk if you think global warming is a hoax." "One has to be very careful, in my opinion, of getting too far out in front of these claims, because it can come back to haunt you," Stavins said. For many years, presidents dealt with natural disasters as acts of God, spending little time litigating their causes and devoting most of their energy to dealing with the aftermath. But over the past decade, experts have been able to more definitively attribute the strength of the storms to changes in the climate, strengthening the hand of politicians who are urging policy changes, said Paul Bledsoe, who served as a climate advisor to the Clinton White House. we didn't have that in the 1990s when we were trying to warn the American public that this public safety crisis was coming, said Bledsoe, who is now a strategic advisor at the Progressive Policy Institute. Even during President Barack Obama's tenure, it was difficult to conclusively draw the connections between extreme weather events and warming temperatures, he said. Still, the science connecting tornadoes to climate change is limited, he said, which helps explain why Joe Biden has stopped short of attributing the recent tornadoes to the planet's warming. Nonetheless, a volatile issue has become part of the response to natural disasters, an area that had largely been free of politics. Biden in particular has sought to stress unity and empathy after such tragedies, but even his relatively limited statements on climate change in response to reporters' questions have drawn attacks from the right. On other occasions, Biden has been blunt, warning that the country faces a code red moment on climate. We know that decades of forest management decisions have created hazardous conditions across the western forest, but we can't ignore the reality that these wildfires are being supercharged by climate change, he said in remarks after observing areas destroyed by wildfires earlier this year. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki stressed that many communities of all ideological stripes are affected by severe weather events fueled by climate change. But she signaled that Biden's visit on Wednesday would be more about providing comfort to those hit hardest by the recent tornadoes. That visit is really about him receiving an update of the work that's happening on the ground, hearing directly from leaders on what they need more from the federal government, if anything, she said, adding, he's not going to give a major speech while he's there. The president is also likely to stress the need to support the victims and their families. On Saturday, as news of the devastation was emerging, Joe Biden stressed the human cost to those who had lost their homes and worse. My heart aches for those people right now, including the rescuers, he said. Everything is gone, from the baptismal photograph to the wedding picture to the picture of your oldest daughter in a ballet. It's profound. Politicians like Biden are becoming more vocal about extreme weather, just as the public is expressing more concern. A September opinion survey conducted by the nonpartisan Pew Research Center showed that 67% of the American public said extreme weather events are happening more often than in the past, including majorities across all major regions of the country. A 2019 opinion poll from the Washington Post and the Kaiser Family Foundation found that 63% of people who said their area had been affected by severe storms, droughts, or extreme hot days identified climate change as a major factor. Still, wider acceptance of the impact of climate change does not necessarily mean that Americans will back mitigation efforts in large numbers. Many Republicans, elected officials, and even some Democrats have resisted aggressive efforts to curtail emissions, arguing that doing so comes at the expense of workers in industries involving fossil fuels. Revving up the country's battle against climate change after 4 years under President Donald Trump, when the battle was largely abandoned, has been a central theme of Joe Biden's presidency. The climate challenge is one of four major crises he pledged to tackle upon taking office, along with the coronavirus pandemic, the economy, and racial justice. In February, the United States officially rejoined the Paris Climate Accord, a major international agreement from which Donald Trump had withdrawn. Joe Biden also took a leading role at a recent international climate summit in Glasgow, Scotland. Beyond that, climate has been a pillar of Biden's two highest-profile legislative packages, the infrastructure law that recently took effect and a social programs bill that he hopes to push through in the coming weeks. We all know every